Welcome to another episode of the Student Loan Player Podcast. We're going to talk today about why the court cases are looking so bad for some borrowers. And we're going to talk about what borrowers can do about it. Right, Megan? And
right.
We've got today our special guest joining us. I shouldn't say special guest. The right hand of SLP.
Your right hand woman.
The right hand of SLP, Megan McGuire. Welcome, Megan.
Thanks for having me today.
So I'm just so excited to talk about borrowers and what borrowers can do to protect themselves that that I forgot that you're supposed to be the one asking me the questions, right?
Right, yeah.
so just start going.
Let me interview you, because today was a bit of an interesting day so far. We were at lunch listening to the court case hearings, and I video recorded you making some really interesting reactions. So the first thing you noticed, though, when we first started listening to this case was that you said something to the effect of that the judge doesn't even know how ICR works.
Yeah, and if I'm charitable, you know, judges all the time have to look at things that they really don't understand, that are in industries that
Correct.
They don't understand, and like complex histories of things that they're not experts in. So that being said, it was still kind of shocking to me just how little a court that's making a decision on something that could affect millions of borrowers understood about the program they're ruling on. So that was a huge concern. So just for folks, you know, in case there's new people listening, what are all these court cases? What is going on? It's a bunch of lawsuits brought by Republican state elected officials trying to bring down the SAVE plan because they view the SAVE plan as a backdoor effort at widespread loan cancellation, right?
Right.
And I like to joke, it's not really a joke, I guess, per se, but it's like, if a student loan program is less than $100 billion, nobody cares.
Right.
I don't know why, but like, you don't see lawsuits on a program if it's under $100 billion. If it's over $100 billion, there usually is a lawsuit.
There's some
right?
attention, right. Yeah.
Yeah. So I guess like that's why the lawsuit happened. And then it started in the most favorable place that the people trying to sue to block SAVE could bring the lawsuit, right? Which is the Eastern District of the Court of Missouri, which would get appealed to the Eighth Circuit, which is like the most conservative in the whole country,
right.
probably.
Right.
And so they did this intentionally, right, knowing that it would get appealed to this court, and that's where it's at. And this court is going to make a decision. We listened to this hearing at the team lunch. We went out just to listen to it to try
yeah.
to help borrowers make sense of it, right? And I guess the thing that struck me listening to it, I'll give my hot takes.
Right.
So this court not only doesn't understand how IDR and ICR works, like they are very hostile to the idea that the ICR statute permits forgiveness at all. So the judges kept saying, well, IBR explicitly is authorized, and ICR like just says repayment. Well, repayment means paying back what you owe.
Right.
It was a very like conservative leaning view of like a statute, and they're just like, well, you have to pay back your principal and interest.
Yep.
The way they kind of framed it, which I thought was interesting, is they're like, well, Congress did income sensitive repayment, which was 10 years with the FFEL loan program. And then they did ICR, which was not that generous, and not
yeah,
many people could get it.
Years,
but it was 25
20%.
Years, which is a little bit more generous. And then in 2007, Congress passed IBR, which is even yet a little bit more generous.
Yeah, a step to be more generous.
So they were saying, well, Congress did intend for people to get forgiveness, but it was like a stepwise thing where it kept getting more and more generous, but they stopped at IBR.
Which is 15% for graduate students and 10% for new borrowers.
New borrowers.
As of 2014.
Yeah.
Right.
And so like they we're saying that means, you know, the ICR statute usage to be more generous than the SAVE plan is like not what Congress intended, because they were trying to show this pattern of Congress getting more and more generous over time. This Eighth Circuit argument is like the first time I've heard this argument. Like no other court was questioning the ICR statute at all.
Right.
The Republican plaintiffs like brought this argument because they're trying to bring down SAVE. They need a cogent legal theory to bring down SAVE. And one of the ways to do that is just to take down the whole ICR statute that it's based on, right? And so if they did that, what would happen is pay and repay would not be able to be used to get forgiveness. And what the Supreme Court could also end up doing is saying, well, because we want to make the SAVE plan illegal, we're going to say the ICR statute is illegal, which would strike down other plans that people have come to rely on, like the pay and the repay plan, and require people to decide whether or not they need to sign up for the income-based plan if they still want to get PSLF or forgiveness. So it's a really big concern.
It is a big concern. Now, what would you say, though, to people who are going to ask? Because this has been in applications. It's been in promissory notes that people have signed for an income-driven repayment plan. What would you say, or how do you react when you're thinking, oh, man, the pay or repay could be completely taken out of the game? It's just IBR. What would you say to someone who's thinking, like, I signed on the dotted line knowing that this plan was going to be available?
They're saying that it's fine that they're offering the repay and the pay plans. What's not fine is that there's forgiveness attached to it.
Right.
So forgiveness of interest and forgiveness of principal. So I think that that's their argument is, yeah, it's in the promissory note, but they were promising something illegal in the first place.
That they didn't intend, yeah. I think that it starts to come down to intent, it seems like. What was the intent of the law or the statute? And the intent wasn't to get a bunch of loans forgiven. And I think they're figuring that out. They're like, oh, man, this is not good.
Well, and to be honest, it's hard to figure out who to get angry at. Because to be honest, like, I'm a little frustrated because let's say that somebody's really mad at you and you taunt them and you make fun of them and you call them an idiot or whatever. Are you more likely to get punched in the face or not likely to get punched in the face,
more
right?
Likely.
More likely, right? So some of the things the administration did that was genius was like the IDR waiver, the PSLF waiver, right? They were like, people could get, you know, as much as $2 billion or they were like, you could get at least $2 billion in forgiven loans. Like, they were very much downplaying it, right? They were very much stealth mode, trying to be careful, trying to limit up what they said. And it was working, and they were getting the IDR waiver done, and they were getting the PSLF. It was sneaky, but it was smart. It was well designed and smart. And then the SAVE plan, they did it, and it was like, let's have the SAVE plan day of action. Let's accelerate loan forgiveness right before an election. Let's keep touting how the SAVE plan is, you know, quote, the most generous plan in the history of. And then they like did a cost estimate of the SAVE plan, and they assumed that the cancellation plan was going to win. And the Supreme Court, even though everybody knew it wasn't. And so they estimated the cost at like $130 billion when that was assuming the cancellation plan failed. And when the cancellation plan didn't fail, the actual cost is more like $400, $500 billion. I don't know. And a lot of people say, Travis, you're ridiculous. Like, blame the Republican-appointed judges. That's a reasonable thought. Is the goal to, like, win political points, or is it to actually help borrowers? And I think that's my frustration.
Right.
Is, like, so much of this stuff is, like, it's becoming like this, let's win the messaging game instead of like, let's actually help borrowers. And so that's my frustration. So I guess, like, you know, the people realized, the plaintiffs, Republican elected officials realized, well, I can bring this challenge because Biden v. Nebraska was successful. And then we can bring this in like the most hospitable court in the nation for us with the same like Mohila derived challenge. And this puts a lot of things at risk for a lot of borrowers. But I want to also say, while we record this, I also want to say it. People's finances are not as much at risk if the worst case scenario does happen with this than people would think.
If we don't have pay, if we don't have repay. And I think we've talked about that on multiple episodes leading up to this point, kind of preparing for anything. Like, we're still not sure what's going to happen, right? Because today, we're not even exactly sure what this means. It's not over. Right.
So, well, and like, let's say that it is. I mean, I like to say, like,
as a
former bond trader, what you're supposed to do
worst case.
Let's say the creditor stops paying you. Let's say they default. What assets can you seize? Like, how bad does it get? How much money do you lose?
Yeah.
Like,
what's the floor? What's the bottom of
what's
this?
What's the floor outcome, right?
Yeah.
So the floor outcome is that you have a very extreme Eighth Circuit decision. Trump wins the election, doesn't challenge it in front of the Supreme Court. Or that Kamala wins and you have appeal to the Supreme Court that makes the same decision, right, as the Eighth Circuit.
So pay is gone, repay doesn't come back, save is gone.
Right. So the only thing that exists is IBR. If that were the case, anybody with a partial financial hardship, which means that your required IBR payment is lower than the standard 10-year, would still qualify to sign up. And you could still get PSLF. You could just sign up for that IBR plan, pay your 10 years for PSLF. And then you'd be done. And then if you wanted to get forgiveness over a longer period of time because you're in the private sector, then if you took out your first loan as of 2014, which, you know, what's funny is I'm kind of old now. Like, when I started SLP, I felt young, you know,
yeah.
But I'm kind of old now. So it's like, actually, most of our clients, at least half,
they're newer
are new borrowers.
Yes.
As
so
of,
I
as
do
of 2014.
Think that's important to remember.
Yeah.
IBR, I think for a lot of borrowers that you used to work with at the very beginning, 2017, 2018, old IBR was the plan at the time compared to pay or repay because that's the age demographic of who you were working with at the time. 15% of discretionary income, 25-year timeline to forgiveness. But IBR is also a 20-year term and a 10% of discretionary income if you borrowed after 2014. And so, like,
that's
you're saying...
That's the pay plan.
Yes,
the pay plan.
It's exactly the
that's
pay plan.
That's literally the pay plan.
So a lot of people are actually eligible for that. Even my double consolidation people who borrowed loans recently.
Well,
that,
and funny enough, like, the double consolidation is part of the rule, the SAVE plan
so
rule.
Yeah, so if they throw out this
and
whole
so,
rule,
yeah.
then double consolidation doesn't have that July 2025
which
timeline
is,
anymore.
Which is the only good thing. But, you know,
yes,
like...
It's only, yes, so Parent Plus folks, I've
well,
got
and
you.
There's, and there's family size changes. Like, your family size for married filing separately might be the same as what your family size is, and people could double count it too.
Right. Like, if they bring back the family size, because that was another thing that they did to kind of quickly recap that. It used to be the family size calculation, it would reduce the discretionary income that you were working off of when you were calculating your payment.
Yeah.
So it was a lot more generous for people filing separately. Now it's not as generous.
So if I could explain that just like
an
example. So let's say you have a family size of four and you both have loans and you're both on pay. Like the old rule was we'll file separate and each of you claims family size of four.
Right.
So if you have a poverty line of 30,000, 1.5 times the poverty line, 150% of the poverty line is 45,000. If you file a joint, you just deduct the 45. But if you file separate, then you each get to deduct the 45.
Right. So it
before they take the 10%. And the new rule is like, well, no, family size of four, one borrower claims three, one borrower claims one. Mm-hmm. You don't get to double dip, right?
Yeah, they basically took away the double dipping.
Yeah.
But if this whole thing is thrown out, that comes back in a positive way.
So like in other words, like the pay plan now would be even more generous, right? Mm-hmm. So if the pay plan's even more generous via the new IBR plan, some borrowers actually might save a couple thousand dollars a year.
Certain situations, this can work out well. So I don't want everyone thinking that this is like the worst news ever and that you need to go stress about this right now.
Well,
I think there is some of that, but I think also you might still be better off than you think. I think you just may not have even been looking at the IBR plan previously because we didn't have to. We had the pay plan.
Well, yeah. So. And you know, one thing I'm thinking about is the people that are in the save plan forbearance. A non-zero number of those people do need to pay off their loans, know they need to pay off their loans, are ready to pay off their loans, and are just logically waiting until their interest subsidy ends.
Yeah,
right?
true.
And so there is a subset of people that like knows that eventually their save plan payment would get recertified, but everybody's on these 2018, 2019 tax return certified
old
plans,
income,
right?
Yeah.
Like, so save plan people are on, you know, they're paying, you know, $300 a month, $400 a month, and they're getting all these subsidies, even though their income's way higher. And they, you know, once they have to recertify their income, they won't get any interest subsidies on the SAVE plan if it wasn't repealed, right? In other words, there's a lot of people that wouldn't get the subsidy anyway. Those people will not be super affected because they wouldn't have got the subsidy anyway if SAVE gets repealed, right?
Yeah. So you guys are using this as a, kind of a placeholder for now. Rightfully so. Let's take advantage of it. But now we got to get down to business on paying
And like the people doing IBR. So it's like, well, the people that are younger who haven't had as much time to build up assets, those folks still have access to pay, and if this new rule struck down, it might be even better via the new IBR
new
plan.
IBR, yeah.
And then if people are older and you get taken off of pay, put onto the old IBR plan where it's 15% of income, 25 years until forgiveness, the only positive you could say is, well, at least you've had more time to build assets. And the idea would be if you're probably a great forgiveness candidate under pay, you're probably a great forgiveness candidate under IBR, old IBR too.
Yes.
Like, you know, if you're a pharmacist with $200,000 of loans, $100,000 of income, the pay plan is really good. But if you were kicked off of onto old IBR, you'd still rather do old IBR
than paying back. Yeah. You might have to be more intentional about saving and reducing AGI and doing tax planning for married filing separate to exclude spousal income if that's applicable. But it still could be a good option.
I think there's like two groups of people that would really get hurt with this. And I say really get hurt, I'm going to say like the one that would get mildly hurt and the one that would get really hurt.
Okay.
So the one that would get mildly hurt would be like a physician in private practice that doesn't have quite a high enough income to justify paying it off. Like maybe like a primary care physician with $250,000 of income, $300,000-ish of loans, right? Private sector. They don't qualify for PSLF. That person might be a great pay-as-you-earn candidate right now, but if they got pushed onto old IBR,
the 5 extra years,
extra income, it might make a big difference, and they wouldn't go for forgiveness.
Yeah.
Or you could say the same thing about like a dentist or dental specialist. If they're making a really high income at the very end of their career, those extra 5 years really hurt whether or not you should go for forgiveness. And in that case, income-driven is still an option that keeps your payment low. So get all your other finances rock solid, lock all that stuff down, and then decide.
Then shift focus to prioritize maybe the student loans.
And, you know, I say it's like burning the bridge behind you, crossing the Rubicon, right? Like that's what refinancing your loans is. It's like, you know, you're forever giving up all of the future pandemics that could happen that could freeze your interest. I mean, like hopefully that never happens again, right? For non-student loan reasons. So that's one group of people.
That's less bad.
And then the really bad is and I want to say this in probably a weird example. I'm going to use an example. Like the really bad scenario is the high-income surgeon that has had low payments for a long time because of all the pandemic stuff.
Training, residency.
Has a fairly modest amount of debt relative to their income because that's in an academic hospital. So, like, the scenario I'm worried about is the PSLF borrower who no longer has a partial financial hardship, right? So that they're 6 or 7 or 8 years into PSLF. They have maybe 2 years left to go. And the elimination of all these plans requires them to switch to the IBR plan, and now they have to recertify their income.
And when they
go to do that, they have a $400K income, a $250K loan debt, and they make too much to actually have the personal financial hardship to get on to the PSL plan in the first place.
Right.
So, like, now they have 2 years left to go. Under the old regime, they could have gotten capped payments or something like that, right, if they'd been not switched off of the pay plan or IBR plan onto save, or they could have temporarily paid, you know, $3,500 a month for 2 years and gotten PSLF on the rest. But those folks, if this worst case scenario happened, could be completely cut off from PSLF. The only good news about that would be that at least the lower income specialties, the lower income public servants, like, still could get PSLF even in this apocalyptic scenario, right? So it would be only the higher income folks that would get really hurt by this.
Right. And going back to intent, that was the intention of PSLF. It was, you know, to help folks with possibly lower incomes.
Well, can I real talk, though?
Yeah, go ahead.
I mean, the real talk is that might have theoretically been the intention, but the lobbyists made sure that that wasn't the actual outcome. I mean, like, the whole reason is, like, you know, why are dentists not eligible for PSLF? Why are veterinarians not eligible for PSLF? Why are private sector pharmacists not eligible for PSLF? And the reason is the AMA, the American Medical Association, lobbyists, got a hold of the people writing the loan regulations and got not-for-profit hospitals counting and got, like, a lot of the...
Not just government.
Got a lot of loopholes in place for physicians to get PSLF, and they were really smart about it. And it's kind of like anything in politics, like the people who have the power, the organization, the lobbying influence, those folks get disproportionately more of what they want. And organizations that are smaller, less organized, less well-funded, less of a coordinating lobbying effort get less of what they want.
Right.
So, and we saw this even in hospitals in California that get access to PSLF. You know, how did that happen?
There was some big lobbying.
It was a big lobbying effort. They're very coordinated. They advocated
Texas,
for their
California,
members.
Texas.
And, you know, frankly, if you're one of those folks, like, yay, right?
Yeah,
like,
I know.
You should feel good about that. Like, they advocated for your interests and they succeeded. And so, I don't know. I think that what will happen is if they take away everything but IBR, there will be an outcry.
Yes. It's not going to be quiet.
The judges that are making this decision have no clue what they're doing, right?
They don't understand
what they would be doing if they ripped this apart. And so if that were to happen, you would get millions of borrowers upset, angry. You would have people that are 2 years away from forgiveness, that cardiothoracic surgeon, the brain surgeon, right, that is a very educated constituent is going to be reaching out really upset to their local, like, congressperson or senator, right? And there will be this huge outcry, and people will be so mad.
Might be a boycott.
Yeah, well, this is not fixing Medicare or Social Security. Even though it's very expensive to fix some of these programs, it is not anywhere close to fixing, like, the big things.
Yeah.
So this is the thing, that if you got enough angry, educated people lobbying their representatives, that they would very likely listen and pass something, right?
Yes, yeah.
And maybe, if you want to ascribe some positive motives to somebody challenging this, it would be that that's what they want. They want Congress to say what they want. Now, Democrats would say, well, Congress did say what they want.
Right.
And that's what the fight's about. But what I think would happen is if you have a massive battle or if you have a massive outcry, if they would stop something, repeal something, you would see a lot of, you know, momentum behind getting new legislation in place that would make it possible for some people to access some version of the repay plan or the save plan, or make IBR have no payment cap, for example. They could revise that to make it possible for people to get loan forgiveness.
Right.
So
to kind of help with those particular pain points.
Right.
And you said, too, you thought that there might be something where maybe we're boiled down to just IBR, but you think there could still be a chance that it's positioned more, or it turns more into something like repay, like you're just saying, like no payment cap, maybe a lower payment.
Well, the
maybe not as generous subsidies.
The moderate Republican senators proposed eliminating IBR and replacing it with repay and codifying it.
Yeah.
And their argument was, like, President Obama passed this. Like, President Obama wanted the repay plan. Like, he thought that was an improvement on IBR. So, like, why don't we just take that and just say, because everybody, I think, in Washington agrees there's too many payment plans,
yes,
right?
Yes, I think, exactly. That's what I was going to say, is it's already complicated. And I think everyone's on the same page with things need to be a little more simple. And that was the purpose of SAVE. But SAVE was also, it had ulterior motives of being very, very generous, getting some sneaky forgiveness in there. But
yeah, I mean, I think they could have achieved it if they just kept their mouth shut. I'm just going to say that. But that's just, they didn't. So it's right. Like, and I guess, you know, if in politics you want to celebrate your achievements. I mean, yeah. Shoot, if I did something really cool,
I
want to tell people. I tell everybody. Yeah. I can't keep secrets, right, Megan? I want credit. I tell everybody. I'd be like, hey, guys, guess what I did, you know? Right. I mean, so I'm a little hypocrite here, but, you know. Yeah. So I guess if you're a borrower, the gist is, if you're, like, so confused, you're so overwhelmed, like, don't be. There's still all these things you can do. Filing separately. So actually, a couple things. Like, filing separate for taxes and tax strategy is more important than ever.
Yes, and you said that. I think you stressed that multiple times. Yeah. And that's very, very true, because it gives you the most flexibility in your options, because that's what you want right now, is you want options.
Right.
You don't want to be backed into a corner and have to wait until the next tax year to make decisions or make changes to something.
So if you're not using us for taxes, I would say probably file separately.
Yeah.
Probably extend your taxes, file an extension.
Potentially extend, because that helps with the recertification.
Yeah.
Gives you some flexibility there on when and what income you're reporting.
And lower your AGI every single way you can, like 401k, QBI.
Like, HSA, yeah. QBI, FSA dependent
457,
care.
457. Mm-hmm. Everything you possibly can do to lower your taxable income, because, you know, solo K or whatever, like, just because that will give you the greatest chance to have a partial financial hardship to get onto the plan if you need to.
Community property states too.
Oh,
like,
man,
if your spouse plans to contribute to, like, that's another avenue, because half the income is going to be split between you two anyways.
Yeah.
But there's a lot more strategy with community property states, because we could either use the tax return income that's split in half for the household income, or we could use alternative documentation of income. There's a lot of different things we could do with you guys.
And please don't do anything illegal. Like, I keep
please
seeing
don't.
All these, I would call them like TikTok type of tips,
yeah.
And
hot,
like hot takes,
but like
which
illegal
some are okay,
takes.
But some
illegal
are really
hot takes.
Well, so one is that, you can just maximize your 401k with one pay stub,
yeah.
And then show like a $0 income, and then you can have your payments be $0, you know, a month for the whole year, even if you're making $300,000 a year. No, that's fraud, in my opinion. Like, I think that's like very clearly fraudulent. And like, if the Department of Ed or GAO or anybody ever like audits these programs, right? Like, anybody
that
that's doing the
risk.
Most aggressive stuff could get in trouble, like, because it says under penalty of perjury.
And that's different than like if you lost your job and you applied
different.
To recertify, because
totally
that's like
fine.
Rightfully so, you're out of income or you're between.
And we're
jobs.
Okay with like saying some aggressive strategies, of course. Like, we're like, you know, if
we
you,
like to push the limits,
like, yeah, and
legally.
Like based off of what the rules say, you know. So it's like if you
rule followers,
if you're
sure.
in between jobs, like if you quit one job and you're going to start another in a month, well, you haven't started it yet. Is it true that your taxable income
Answer
is zero
like
at the
an
moment?
Attorney,
yes,
like,
it's
yes
true.
Or no,
right.
Do you have income?
But like,
no.
But I just think that when these cases get decided, people are going to be more like, there's going to be a lot more people coming out of the woodwork.
Right.
And then, you know, depending on.
It might like feel good to feel like you could maybe cheat the system a little bit, because you feel cheated, right?
Yeah.
Behaviorally, you might feel that way, but we got to stay above board.
Well, and we can do PSLF buyback, right? Like, so all the people
Let's
that are
stuck. Let's talk about that a little bit.
Okay, yeah.
Because PSLF buyback, I think, is still a crucial part in this situation, because we don't exactly know what's going to happen with these save forbearance months, right? Like, we know right now they're not counting. But depending on what happens here coming up, if save is no more, if we don't have pay, we don't have repay, PSLF buyback is still something we can lean on to go back and purchase these months of forbearance, or potentially purchase months back to a certain point that weren't going to count for PSLF because they weren't, you know, I don't know. What do you think about this? This is my question.
Well, someone texted me something crazy the other day.
Oh, no.
And they were like, this person had loans from before 1986, before a lot of the loans programs got formalized. And they were like, can we help this person? Their loans are in an Excel spreadsheet. Like, they called Department of Ed, they're like, what? They're like, loans are in an Excel spreadsheet. And he's like, well, they're in default. This person can't afford it. Like, can we just, this is a Department of Ed official asking the person who maintained the file. They're like, can we just delete the row in the spreadsheet, the Microsoft Excel spreadsheet? Can we just like press delete and just have it go away? And they're like, I don't see why not. And they just deleted it.
What?
Okay, so that's like awful that you run a program like that. I mean, it's great for the borrower, right? But it's like, that's, I'm saying that story so that people know how bad the systems and the data is, right?
Yeah.
And so what's going to happen with PSLF buyback is you're going to have to be your own advocate.
Yes.
You're going to have to calculate your own payments. You're going to have to calculate.
Right. And it could be off of the IBR calculation,
yes.
Which I think we've been coaching folks on being the worst case scenario, which could still be a good case scenario if you're that close to PSLF.
But the point is just, you're going to have to be your own advocate. And, you know, if you need the help, we can help. And you can get the help through the podcast. You can get the help through... Mm-hmm. the SLP business or the SLP wealth business. And, you know, there's a lot of different ways that you can get help, including free or paid. So
yeah, we do one-on-one consultations to help you navigate this on a personal level. But also, I think we're giving you a lot of ammo to be your own advocate, like you're saying, and just know what your options are so you at least know what direction to walk in once we have an idea of where the wind is blowing after this whole situation settles.
So we'll say two things before we close. One is, if you need a plan, studentloanplanner.com/book, or reach out to your advisor if you're a wealth client. And then if you just wanting to ask a question, go to studentloanplanner.com/voicemail, and we'll feature some listener questions in an upcoming pod. This is Travis and Megan with the Student Loan Planner podcast. Have a great rest of your week.